from KQED. From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, KQED politics reporter.
And I'm Scott Schaefer, KQED senior politics editor. And today we are excited to have San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon join us on The Breakdown.
Gascon's a former cop turned prosecutor who's been a vocal proponent of many of the controversial criminal justice reforms of recent years. But just recently, he announced that he will not seek another term as DA, citing his mother's ailing health.
And we'll be talking to him about that very difficult and personal decision, also about the state of criminal justice here in California, maybe what it's like being the odd man out at District Attorney Association meetings.
I'm interested in that because I cover the CDAA and I can tell you they don't always agree. But we will get to that in a second. First, we want to talk about the news of the week. And we're actually sitting in the studio where some of the biggest political news happened this week, which was the governor's debate. Scott Schaefer moderated between John Cox and Gavin Newsom. And, you know, it's supposed to be at this point the only debate we're going to have. And I guess, you know, I'm curious. You were sitting in the seat I'm actually in right now.
Yes.
I mean, what were your impressions? Were you happy with the way it turned out? And
you know, going into it, I mean, we knew we had an hour and there were so many competing considerations, you know, in terms of what to cover, what to talk about. We wanted to make sure that we had time to talk about some of the big issues like housing. You know, what was interesting at the very beginning, we brought them both in here and John Cox was sitting here and Gavin Newsom was sitting there. And we had about, I don't know, 3 minutes until the broadcast began. And they immediately started arguing about debates.
It was like debate over debates.
Yeah. I mean, John Cox said, you know, it's too bad this is the only debate. And then, you know, Newsom is like, well, you know, you canceled on CNN. And it was like, whoa, this is going to be an interesting
hour. Yeah, I don't think a lot of love lost between those two.
No. Guys. And then there were a couple of breaks, like minute-long breaks during the hour. Silence.
Yeah.
Like there was no chit chat.
Which is interesting because if you look at, you know, I think there was a very hard fought primary on the Democratic side, although it's an open primary, but, you know, between Villaraigosa, the former LA mayor, and Newsom. But you could see, you know, they've been in politics, they've been around the same circles. And so I think that there's at least on the surface a little more friendliness between those guys during some of the primary debates. None of that.
They don't run
Cox
in the same circle.
No. You know what interested me? So there was a couple moments I was sitting in the control room and I stood up to watch Newsom's face when you asked him about temperament and playing well with others, which he seemed to bristle at.
He did. No, I got that Newsom look where he was like sort of not wanting to hear the question or
we got
give
that
the
look
answer
in the studio when we interviewed him a couple weeks ago.
We did. But you know, he handled it all right, I thought. And you know, we talked about housing. We had a good, I thought, substantive discussion on housing. You know, I think John Cox was a little unhappy right after the debate. As we were walking out of the studio, he was complaining that I had raised some of the issues of his comments, you know, years ago about gay marriage and transvestite teachers, those kinds of things. But, you know, I feel like, you know, voters have a right to know who these people are.
And he's bringing up stuff that Newsom did 10, 15 years ago. So I think it's all fair game. I mean, I think, interestingly, you also saw in the aftermath of the debate some very big differences between these candidates. Newsom came out, held court in front of the media. Cox basically refused to answer questions. There's some video that some of our colleagues shot of him, you know,
kind running into the green
running
room.
To the green room and then to the exit. And, you know,
it's not a good look.
It's not. And I think that it does speak to the sort of, again, differences in, first of all, experience, you know, in terms of what these guys have done in the past, and then just also relationships with reporters. Like, I think Cox tweeted out a couple weeks ago a photo of us with Newsom when he came in for a Political Breakdown. And I'll say it one more time, John Cox, we would love to have you on
the show. Political Breakdown.
And, you know, but the bottom line is, like, Democrat, Republican, you're in the press and you cover these guys for 10 years. You do have a relationship with people.
But, you know, there's another part to that. We were all down in Orange County a few weeks ago and covering the congressional races down there. And Young Kim, who's running for Ed Royce's seat, the Republican, gave me time, talked with her. But the three incumbents down there
did not.
And, you know, I think there's just been, over the years, has become a much more adversarial relationship, unfortunately, between the media or much of the media and Republican candidates. And it's really
national candidates, because that doesn't exist in Sacramento. I think we have really good relationships with most of the Republicans up there. And, you know, anyway.
Yeah. And so, I think Young Kim benefited from talking to me. I mean, in terms of the coverage, because we got her point of view, you know, in the story.
Well, I want to turn next to a debate that's not a debate that is
happening
next week. Between two Democrats. one of which has come on our show, Kevin DeLeon, state senator, who is challenging longtime U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein. He has been asking for debates. She has demurred, let's say.
Yes.
And this will be at PPIC in San Francisco next week. A conversation moderated not by a journalist, but by Mark Baldessari.
Mark Baldessari, the president, yeah.
And so, I don't know. I think that, you know, at least they're going to share a stage, I guess. But I think there's a lot of disappointment that this isn't.
Yeah. And I think, look, we've seen this time and again. And we saw it with the governor's debate, where typically whoever's in front or whoever's the incumbent has the most to lose by debating, whereas the challengers or the person who's behind, you know, wants to try to get some momentum back. And Dianne Feinstein has not debated since the year 2000. She debated Tom Campbell, the moderate.
I was in college.
Right. Bill Clinton was president. You know, it was a long time ago. And, you know, they've had excuses for that over the years. You know, she has run against some very weak candidates.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
I think that this year, though, you have someone who, regardless of the poll numbers, is an established, serious
candidate.
Candidate. And, you know, so anyway, it'll be an interesting conversation. But I know, Scott,
hopefully.
I'm sure something will be interesting about it. But, you know, you wrote a story this week on our website about sort of the debate about debates and whether there should be sort of compulsory debates, like if we should have a system like the presidential system has.
Yeah, I got to thinking, you know, we've had presidential debates without debate, really, since 1988. And the reason is that there is a presidential debate commission. It was formed.
Another blue ribbon commission.
Well, yes, but they're there all the time. And they're, you know, they have credibility with both parties. Because it was started with the former chair of the RNC and the DNC, and every year since 1988, every presidential year, there's been a debate, and it's broadcast, and everybody kind of buys into it. And I just got to thinking, why don't we have a version of that in California? You know, some kind of a blue ribbon commission,
right,
whose job it's bipartisan or nonpartisan, whatever you want to call it, with credible folks that plans the debates, because I think the voters do benefit. I mean, I'm not sure how much of a difference debates make in the end in terms of influencing the outcome of an election. But, you know, you do have an opportunity, voters do, to see these two candidates, the finalists, going head to head.
And just, I would say, too, as a reporter, like one of the things about debates is sort of what I alluded to, which is it's not just about the policy positions they stake out. It's about temperament and personality. And how do you respond when you're being pressed on something? Or how do you share a stage with someone who's your adversary? I think those things are telling and they're
important. They are.
And so that's my PSA for the day. Let's take a short break. We will be joined by San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon when we get back. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer along with Marisa Lagos, and we're here with San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon.
Welcome.
Good
well,
to have you.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. It's great to see you guys.
Great to see you, too. And I think there's a lot we want to cover with you, but I think we have to start with the news of the last few weeks, which is your pretty shocking decision, I think, to a lot of people not to seek re-election. So how'd that conversation in your head go? Like, what?
And how long had you been thinking about it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so not very long. It was really a decision that was made over a very short period of time, really about 2 weeks, sort of boiling to Sunday a couple of weeks ago, saying, okay, this is what I have to do.
And we should just say that this is about your mom, who is 90 years old.
This is about my mom, right? So, you know, my dad, both my mother and father, well, my dad now passed, lived in Southern California. I have no siblings, so it's just me. And, you know, frankly, as you get further into your life, you know, you start losing your networks because, you know, the longevity has a two-edged sword, right? It's great that you have longevity, and then you also... So most of her networks have really started to disappear. She's very lonely. She refuses to move. She basically, this is where my dad and her lived their last couple of decades or plus. But when my dad passed about 5 years ago, I had the freedom of going back and forth almost every weekend for a while. And you know, frankly, that was very important for me, for him, for her. And, you know, as I see now some signs of, that she needs me more than ever, probably, you know, she's lonely and there are other issues going on. You know, she's been an incredible woman, and she has been very supportive of me. And, you know, one of the things that I said in my note, which I sincerely believe I'm have been very lucky to be surrounded by very strong women, right? I mean, she was there for me. Quite frankly, her mother, my maternal grandmother, was incredible. And, you know, both of my grandfathers died before I was born, so I never got to meet them. Yeah. Then, you know, I happen to have two daughters. I have an incredible wife. So, and they have all given everything for me. And, you know, you only have, in most cases, one, perhaps two mothers. And that's it, right? Yeah. And, you know, careers and jobs, you know, as important as they are, you know, they can be replaced. You cannot replace people that you love.
Yeah.
And that time that you're going to have with her as a result of this.
Right.
You can't get that back.
That you would have been campaigning over the next year.
Well, and that was it. You know, we kind of look back, you know, in 2011 when I was campaigning. And, you know, basically for about 9 months, I didn't have a single day off.
Right.
Right? You know, I have a busy job, too, which I'm very committed to doing till the end and doing it right. So there was no way I could put the three buckets, you know, work, campaigning, and her. So it was what was going to give up. It was obviously the campaigning.
Yeah, and I think that is something. You know, I remember during the gubernatorial debate during the primary, there was a question about sacrifice that you asked, I think.
Yeah.
And, like, I do think it's fair to say it is a sacrifice to run for public office. You do right. sacrifice a lot of your life, and you've had a very remarkable life and career.
Thank you.
So let's take it back to the very beginning. You
All
were
right.
born in Cuba.
Yes.
What do you remember about life there?
Well, you know, I'm just going to summarize because obviously we could make the whole show about this. But, you know, my father was a revolutionary, right? So he fought to overthrow Batista.
Right.
But he was not, you know, he did not believe in communism. So when the regime became, you know, he was sort of a idealist Democrat. And that led to, you know, a lot of unhappiness, a lot of problems. You know, one of my uncles wound up in prison for 18, 19 years
wow.
for political activities. And those early years of the revolution were pretty brutal. I mean, the people think that only the rich people left Cuba. Those people left in the first year and mm-hmm. a half. They were gone right away. The next waves of people were working class people, you know, and so it was hard.
And how old were you when you left?
Yeah, I was 13.
Okay.
So you remember quite a bit. Then.
I do. And, you know, I have been back since, and frankly, I'm really glad that I did. I went back about 5 years ago, and you know, I still have family there, and it was important, important for me.
Why did you come? I mean, a lot of people, of course, Cubans who leave go to Florida,
right.
Or that part of the country at least. How did you end up in California?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, a good part of my family actually left Cuba before the revolution in the mid 50s, and they actually resided in Providence, Rhode Island. Now, at that time, there were not a lot of Cubans.
Such a hotbed of Cubans.
Oh, I know. And what happened is in the early 60s, my paternal grandmother started having problems with arthritis, and the doctor says, you got to get to a dry climate, and he suggested either Phoenix or L.A. And so they stopped in Phoenix, and, you know, Phoenix early 60s was really a one-horse town. And they said, nah, you know, and they got to L.A. Of course, L.A. already had a thriving Latino community, and so they settled there. So when we left Cuba, we came straight to L.A.
And so you go to L.A., you don't speak English, from what I understand.
Nope.
None at all.
Not at all.
Wow.
Not at all.
You picked up surfing. Is that
I
right?
picked up surfing. I dropped out of school. You know, a lot of
really
people
really embraced
LA. Yeah, I did. I dropped out of high school. You know, really. You know, I struggled in the early years. Mm-hmm. I struggled with the language. I, you know, just a young immigrant kid. You know, frankly, my neighborhood was very poor. Actually, it was very rare in my neighborhood to be a surfer. So that was the other. So I was kind of an oddball there. You know, so sometimes people tell me you're always been an oddball. I say, yeah. You know, there were not a lot of surfers in my neighborhood, but I met some kids in high school that were surfers, and you know, I grew up around the beach in La Habana, and so that was
And you joined the military, right?
I did. And that, you know, for me, that was a turning point, frankly. That was my real mentors in the early stages became the people that I work around, and that's how I, you know, went back to school, got my, finished high school because, of course, I had to take a GED test to get in. But then, you know, I actually went back and finished, got my high school diploma. I started going to college while I was in the Army. And then,
this
of course,
is during the Vietnam War, right?
This is right after.
Oh, it's right
after. Yeah, well, you know, the war was really on the tail end. This was after the Paris talks, and so they really, there were no, in fact, I mean, the when I first went in, I had a full expectation that I was going to end up going to Vietnam. And, you know, my father was a very red-blooded patriot, and he's, you know, to the day he died, you know, he's probably more American than many Americans because, you know, American by choice, right, in many ways. And he said, you know, this is the right thing to do, son, is to go serve this country.
And did that reflect sort of more conservative politics of his and then and you as well?
Unquestionably. I mean, you know, post the Bay of Pigs, being a Cuban in the U.S. was almost mandatory you would be a Republican,
right?
I mean, the Kennedy administration, even though they tried to later on unwind some of this stuff, you know, people don't understand that. And you know, and there were good public policy reasons for America, right? But not necessarily for the Cubans that went in the invasion, right? But these people were promised, they were trained by the CIA, they were promised support. And then literally, as they were landing, the air support and everything was left. And they were left in the middle of a beach with no support. And they all wound up either getting killed or going to, you know, being captured.
Sure. Yeah. So we could talk about all this all night. Yeah. But I want to move on. So you became you went to college, you became a police officer. You worked at LAPD for many years, including, I think, during the Rampart scandal and some of the corruption there. You ended up becoming police chief in Mesa, Arizona, which is the same county where Joro Pio was basically rounding up Mexican immigrants.
Yep.
I'm just curious, like, when did, and we're going to get to, I think, some of your more sort of progressive policy around criminal justice things, but were those seeds planted in Cuba during Rampart, in Mesa? I mean, how did you kind of come to where you ended up when you were hired in San Francisco as the police chief?
Yeah, well, you know, see, this is the interesting thing. Okay, so my dad has always been was always a very progressive man, right? But he was a Democrat, not on the party sense of the word, but in, you know, believing in democracy
Little
and freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and we were poor, you know, my parents worked for minimum wage for many years, you know, so really a working class family. You know, my uncle was a union, the head of a union in La Habana. And so we were kind of a Republican, probably with a small R. We were a Republican when it came to foreign policy and Cuba, and then everything else, really, he was a Democrat, probably. So I grew up in that, you know, that environment that's somewhat conflicting at times. And then, you know, I grew up in a very poor neighborhood, right, where a lot of the kids that I went to drop out of school like I did. Many wound up, you know, not doing well.
On the wrong side of the law.
So when I became a police officer, initially, by the way, I was going to be a teacher, right? So I even started my thoughts were to teach. And then, you know, it evolved into going into the police department. I always went with an idea that, you know, I wanted to be in the same places that I grew up, kind of the same places, and make a difference. So that was sort of the beginning, you know. And then, you know, as years went by, I became more disenchanted with the way that public safety was heading, you know, the increasingly more punitive way of doing things, the more mass incarceration. And it was really by the late 1990s, early 2000 that I started to say, this is, you know, I don't see this having, I saw the unfairness about, you know, drug policy, for instance. I mean, like, you take drug use across the board, right? There is no ethnic, there is no gender, there is no economic divide, right? Americans use drugs at equal amounts, or maybe sometimes even more when you're wealthy. But when you look at the people that we were arresting, right, they were all happened to be black and brown.
So when you came, you were recruited to come here from Arizona. You became the police chief in San Francisco.
Right.
Gavin Newsom hired you, I guess you could say. What was that culture shift? What was that culture? Was it a welcome culture change for you going from, you know, Mesa to San Francisco? Or was it kind of a shock?
You know, it's mixed. It's nuanced, right? First of all, it was one of your colleagues that pointed out to me several years ago during a TV show, says, you know, do you understand that you, and she did some research, so she was somewhat founded. I don't know how this is rated, but she says, you came from the most conservative, politically conservative city in the country, major city, because Mesa's considered a major city, over 500,000 people, to the most liberal. Mm-hmm. And says, and how do you reconcile the two? And what I told her, and I believe that to this day, you know, the basics of public safety are, you know, is meeting a human need and the necessity of civilized society that you need to have public order. The question how you get there sometimes may vary a little, but, you know, we all want to be safe in our homes. We want to, you know, feel comfortable with our families and all that stuff. So to that end, you know, I met and still have relationships with incredible people in Mesa that were very supportive of my work. And even when I got embroiled in the immigration fights, which were incredible, I mean, that was probably one of the most stressful periods of my life. I mean, because there were even death threats regularly. And
this is when you bumped up
when
against
I bumped
Arpaio.
Up with Arpaio, yeah, yeah. And, you know, and sort of opened up this can of worms. I mean, I was getting hate mail from Texas and other parts of the country. It was just insane. Most of the people in my community were very supportive. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize about 30% of the population in Mesa is actually Latinos.
Right.
And,
it's like who votes versus who lives somewhere.
Exactly. Right. So, but even county government being mostly Republican, but, you know, a lot of Mormons, and, you know, a lot of people don't realize that, for instance, the Mormon church, the largest growth of the Mormon church in the last two or three decades in Latin America.
Yeah.
Mm, wow. Yeah.
So you fast forward a little bit more because we are running short on time. So you become a police chief here. You really, I think, butted heads, it would be fair to say, with the Police Officers Association, right, and some of the rank and file. And then Newsom gets elected, or Kamala Harris gets elected to be Attorney General, and Newsom names you District Attorney, which I think surprised a lot of people at the time.
Surprised me?
Yeah. And then you became this champion, unlike really, I would say, any other prosecutor in California, right, for a lot of the criminal justice reforms. We've seen Prop 47, which is still incredibly controversial. Mm-hmm. You've championed bail reform. But you're also overseeing an office of prosecutors whose job it is to, you know,
lock
people up. Right. Have you... Is that hard to reconcile those two things? Because I think it's very easy to say, in theory, I support this criminal justice reform, but, you know, I'm sitting in front of a victim and I want there to be justice for these people.
Right, right. Actually, no. I mean, I think it's actually very congruent, right? Smart public safety requires that you think about not only the impact on the moment, but also you're thinking about the impact on the community overall, that you're thinking about the impact on social fabric of your community, the economic impact that you will have in a community. And here's what I tell people. I think this is the best way for me to illustrate my point. We have a criminal justice system that has failed. And here's how I'd say it. Look, about 70% of the people that we touch go back and reoffend, right? If you walk into a counter of an airport in front of, you know, to an airline clerk, and you tell, and the clerk tells you, you know, you have a 70% chance that this plane is going to fall, would you buy a ticket on that plane? And the answer is obviously not. But when it comes to the criminal justice system, we have continued to buy that ticket over and over again at the expense of building schools. You know, we build more jails, more prisons. And at some point, we have to realize that it's not making us any safer.
One of the most difficult things I would imagine that a DA, especially a progressive DA like yourself, has to deal with is when, you know, that tension between communities of color and police departments, in particular when there's a shooting, right, you know,
it's
use of force,
ongoing issue
in, yeah, San Francisco, and in particular, say, the Mario Woods shooting in, right, the Bayview, and you have to decide whether or not you're going to prosecute, right, a police officer. Talk about that tension that goes on within your office between the PD and the DA.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and it's painful for me on many levels because, you know, first of all, I'm not somebody that came into the law as a prosecutor, as a lawyer, right? I walked the streets of South LA for years. I went through the ranks. So I know good policing. I know bad policing. I know when police make legitimate mistakes. I know when they don't many times. And, you know, I know there were many times where I could have used deadly force, but I didn't, right? Because I felt that I didn't have to, right? And the problem with a lot of the police training and the law is that the law has become so permissive around police use of force that a very unreasonable level of fear within an officer's moment, because it's really a split-second moment, that can lead to the use of deadly force and really tragic consequences. And you can look at it and you say, this may be a lawful shooting under current law, but was it necessary? Was this a minimum amount of force necessary? And this is really where the conflict comes in, right? Because some people say, well, you know, if it wasn't necessary, then you should act on it. And I said, look, I mean, that's policy decision. The chief of police can fire people for that, right? I'm looking at it through the legal lens and only through the legal lens. And while I may stand up, as I did in the case of Mario Woods, and say, I think this was an unnecessary shooting, or the one for Gongora, I had to say at the same time, this, under current law, these are lawful shootings.
And you supported changing the law, right?
Absolutely. I was the only law enforcement person, the only DA that actually supported this, the 931.
Which brings me to the question I want to ask, which is, like, what's it like being in those meetings with all those other DAs and being the one person like that? And sort of more broadly, I mean, as someone who stands where you do politically, like, what do you think the public needs to know about prosecutors and the power they kind of wield around these policy conversations?
Well, let me... Look, I mean, first of all, and I think that people have finally come to realize that, and that's why you see this big movement around the nation about, you know, how to shift the dialogue around prosecutors. No, prosecutors, especially prosecutors in major cities in this country, control mass incarceration. I mean, it's true there are laws that support that, but really, at the end of the day, it is the prosecutor that makes the ultimate decision, you know, how I'm going to intervene with a case and to what level, and that's becoming crystal clear now to many people. I think that... Also, I have to say that, you know, by and large, you know, most prosecutors are ethical people that want to do the right things. They do the things that they believe in. You know, my generation of people in public safety grew up in the area of locking people up, right? And that was, you know, we became hammers, and when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And I think it's hard for people, for human beings. I mean, I don't care if you're a doctor or lawyer or whatever, it's very hard to start diverting in a different direction when you believe in what you're doing and the way you're doing it. So a lot of these conversations are maybe tense, but I don't think people are coming from a wrong place on this. Also, I think the electoral process speaks to this stuff, right? I mean, you see even in San Francisco now, right? There are people talking about, well, we need to start locking up some of the homeless, and then come and say, well, first of all, I don't know that we have the tools to do that. So even if we wanted to, you know, people don't realize that the tools are not there for that. But then you have to think more basically, do we want to start sending mentally ill people and people that are poor, that, you know, to jail or prison? Is that the kind of society that we want to be? Is that the solution to the problem?
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen a lot, like, where DAs also resign and then sort of anoint the next successor while their term is still up.
We have just like 20 seconds left. What do you think the city needs in the next DA, and are you going to make an endorsement at some point?
Yeah, I don't think I'll make an endorsement. I think it will be important for the process to, you know, to be open. I think that what we need is somebody that is going to come in and obviously do their own thing and put their own stamp, but there are things that we've done. There's a lot of progress, whereas the use of data, the reform process that we have, the interventions that we do, the use of restorative justice with juveniles and all that stuff, that I hope that they will continue to make that better.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming in, George Gascon.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure to both of you. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown, a production of KQED Public Radio.
You can check out all of our elections coverage. We're calling it our voter guide. It's at kqed.org/elections. And we also have a newsletter. You can subscribe to that at kqed.org/politicalbreakdown.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati, and our engineer is Seal Muller.
Ethan Lindsay is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our chief content officer. I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Scott.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Find me at MLagos. That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We will see you next week.
Bye-bye.